the topic for today is personality redeemed. And I had already left the title in English. We were talking about that a minute ago. Because it's sometimes tricky to find the right words. Redeemed, how would you translate that in Dutch? We'll come back to that and see if you have some good suggestions. And the basic easy choice would be verlost or hersteld or vrij. Gezet, vrijgemaakt, that sort of thing. But we can think about that. But I, just to be honest, I guess to start, this topic is the one, I think the topic that has kept me the most busy in my years here in Labrie, just for myself, my own search and learning about how it's possible to grow in your faith. But it's also, I think, what I've often found the most exciting and difficult and surprising in all the conversations I've had with people over the years, which I guess would be some hundreds of people by now. And it's been something that never gets boring and always comes back. And it, I think, also kind of has my heart, you could say, as I think it's one of the most clear places that we have a chance to see what the Christian gospel means really in a concrete way for this life and the here and now, and not just for something after this life, after this life as we know it here. I like it to have something to do with the life we know, where we live. For me, also as a person, the person that I am. So the question then really for today is if the gospel, evangelie, okay, which means good news, if that really is good news for my life, if it really is about salvation, change, or improvement, that was much nicer in Dutch, verlossing, verbetering, or verlossing, or verandering, all these fair words, I'm sorry, but if it really is about change or growth in one way or another, what does that mean, according to the Bible? What does that look like, practically speaking, from one week to the next in this life here? Now then, just to start, I think behind and maybe underneath all my own points that I want to share with all of you today, there are two general lessons that I've learned in Dutch Labrie since I've been here in Holland. Two deep lessons that I think make a good foundation for everything I want to share with you. And the first one comes from this guy, Professor Rookmaker, Hans Rookmaker, who is actually the one who began the Labrie work here in Holland in the late 60s, early 70s. And among other things, Professor Rookmaker was known mostly for this statement. He said, very often and repeatedly, and actually quite often in English, Jesus did not come to make us Christian. He came to make us more fully human. Okay, he liked to make controversial statements as well, so he really wanted to push something here. Jesus did not come to make us Christians or to make us Christian. He came to make us more fully human. And what did he mean by that? Well, he meant the whole point of Jesus coming to live and to die and to raise again as a fulfillment of the biblical prophecies and the law. And also the point in everything he taught was not to communicate a certain kind of behavior as important or to create some kind of subculture as an alternative to the world or to promote a certain type of character as more holy or required, these things that we sometimes now call Christian, if we talk about it, especially in Holland, what is Christelijk. The point was to become free, to live a life as a human according to the original way it was intended by God when he made us. Okay? That God had a certain intention as a creator when he made human beings and built them, and this world that he then also gave human beings, and all the relationships that we find ourselves in here in this world, relationships with each other, relationships with the things and the environment around us, and relationships with him. Okay, so the gospel begins not with the problem and an answer to it. The gospel begins actually with creation and the gift of what was good. Then the problem came and there is a restoration of what was intended. Okay, that's the whole point. Meaningfulness of a life marked by shalom, which means peace, but not just peace in the sense of no war, no crime, no abuse, no hate, or no disease, no death, all said negatively. The point of shalom is actually to define it positively, a life marked by movement and dynamic and fullness, a life that grows and blooms free from the crippling effects of all those other things. Okay, so the point is the movement actually, not just the removal of something. So, moving as it was intended, the way we were built. Okay, Christ came to put that back on track, you could say. Not just to bring new religious rules and habits to put on top of it. Okay, so to make us free to be more fully human. Now, that's the first lesson. The second lesson I've learned here, one of the basic deep ones, comes from our very own Wim Rietkerk, under whose leadership Dutch Labrie grew and I think took the form which we all know and enjoy now today. Labrie here is a place where people can come and give time and thought and attention to certain questions, like, is this really true, that God really exists, that he really made this place in a certain way, that he really made us in a certain way. And he's actually told us something about how we can live in a more free way here with each other. Okay, so this first statement of Rookmaker, that Christ didn't come to make us Christian, but to make us more human, well, Wim really sharpened that for me. This idea of salvation and change and improvement, which is offered in the biblical gospel, is not, in the first place, about replacing something, taking something away and putting something in its place. And it's definitely not about destroying something first and putting something else in its place. It's about a restoration, herstel in Dutch, renewing something. Okay, even in the very heavy language of 2 Peter chapter 3, which Wim explains, I think, very originally and wonderfully in this little book about the future of the planet Earth, that heavy language in 2 Peter about the fiery destruction of the Earth and all the elements of the universe melting away, even in that language, the point is not the destruction or the replacement of creation. The point is that it is a refining. Okay, the fire that is mentioned there is traced back even in the same chapter, but also in other prophecies in Malachi and other places in the Bible. If we listen to what God is really doing, the fire there is something that purifies. It's like the fire of the goldsmith. Or another one I really like, the loog van een wolwasser. That's nice. The lie of the washer of wool. I think that would be a great band name, or an album. But the idea of that burning effect is not to destroy in the first place, it's to purify. Okay, that something, I think a beautiful expression in Dutch, that something can kom tot zijn recht. Yeah, I don't know how to translate it in Dutch well. Something that is, do it justice, yeah. That it, something is done justice, that it is allowed to appear in the way it should be, like the pure gold or the clean wool. Okay, so it lets the earth come up and appear actually in the way it was intended from the beginning, set free to grow and to bloom in shalom, the way he made it to. Okay, and we're told in the Bible that the earth itself is begging for this and crying out for it and longing for it. Not to be burnt up and destroyed, but to be freed. Now, next, alongside that, in our library and the recordings, I think maybe it has some metaphorical significance, but recording number one in our catalog is a sermon by Wim about the white stone, the wit stein, from Revelation chapter 2, verse 17. And in that sermon, Wim explains how one of the things God promises his people is that this renewal is not just about creation and the earth itself. It's also about us and our identities. Okay, as a part of the creation, each one of us, with a special thing added, that we are image bearers of God, of the Creator Himself. The biblical message then is not that if I am to be saved or if I am to be set free in the way the gospel offers, the image and the message is not that I need to be replaced in my identity. And certainly not that I need to be destroyed in my identity so that something more beautiful or better or Christian can come in its place. That's not the message. In fact, my identity and my person, in the same way as the earth, is crying out for being set free. In a very different idea, being restored, not being removed and replaced. Okay, something in us longs for a relationship with God, to have that be restored in this world, right now, with everything that I recognize in my relationships around me. My relationships with other people, but also things and nature and with God Himself. Okay, the way I'm built. So there is a freedom of being set free, a liberation intended there. That's so individual, okay, and that's Wim's point. It's so specific and unique to who I am that my real name will be given to me on a white stone at the end. That's the promise. And it's so specific and so individual that only the one who receives it can recognize it on that stone. Only the one who receives it can recognize it. It's that individual. My name, my restored identity will be as no other. Okay, only I can recognize it. Because it has to do with the very specific form of my own restoration. Okay, with all the details that only I and God can really know. Okay, so I long for that the same way the earth longs to be restored, even if I'm not aware of it. I think it's beautiful how the Apostle Paul describes this in Acts chapter 17. And we'll come back to that later. In Areopagus in Athens, he says, human beings were built, God says, to look for God in this way. And feeling their way along to try to find Him. Okay, with this sort of hunger that this is the idea. This is the sort of the drive put into us. Okay, not just to find God as the end of some kind of pilgrimage, as though, well, then you find Him and it's done. It's actually the beginning of a new and a living way. The promise in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 20. The gospel is supposed to open a new and a living way, not just be the end or the destination. Okay, so in the knowledge that this is what I'm given, by a God who sees me and knows me and loves me, who offers me this kind of restoration in steps and a path that I can grow on, I'm allowed to long to taste that. That's the word, feeling it along with my senses. Okay, so that was the second lesson I really picked up here at Le Bris. Now, these two lessons, these deep lessons both, well, we could talk about them both for hours. I would love to. So if you want to, come back to Le Bris and we'll do it. But these really opened the message of the Bible for me. That it wasn't about a religion of how I need to die to serve God, how I need to submit my will to God's will, how I need, through this or that kind of discipline or rule, need to become a better Christian person. Okay, those phrases have some validity, but that was not the point, especially when said in a certain way. The point was a restoration from what is made in love. Made in love and restored in love. That's the point. And that's where it really started. And I'll get a little personal about it. The same Wim Rietkerk, he should have been here this morning. I'm giving him compliments in his absence, so I'll feel free to give him all these compliments when he comes. The same Wim is also I think the one person that I know, and those of you that know him will be able to confirm this, he is, I think, the example of a patient person on this planet. And I don't mean that he never feels urgency about certain things, or that things don't move him or get him upset or excited. Of course that happens. But his character, I think, embodies patience. Especially in any atmosphere of distress or chaos or fighting or conflict. I think Wim knows very well how to sort of calm the room, to relativize things, and even to bring things further in a very constructive way so that everybody still feels seen and heard. It's a real gift. It's very special. And I can promise you it's real. I've tasted it many times. Now, as his son-in-law, which I happen to be, I then held this up, I think, for a long time as a great example of what adulthood probably should look like. Okay? This to me seemed like this must be the summum of being a father and a husband, of being a friend and a colleague, of being a citizen or in any calling you can imagine, right? It's also a fruit of the Spirit, right? Patience. You read about it in Proverbs in many places as it's known as a part of wisdom, being a wise person. I've seen it and I've tasted it, as I said, how it can really be a blessing in all kinds of circumstances, big and small. But I can tell you after some years, it is not, it wordt mij niet gegund. I don't know how you say that in English so well. I'm not allowed to have this kind of patience in this kind of way. Okay, I prayed for it for years in a serious way. I studied about it. I tried to practice it. And I experienced a lot of frustration and regret when it didn't work. Sometimes almost despair, especially as a dad. But finally, I listened to those two lessons that we were talking about. That what God wanted from me was not to become another person. That I needed to get myself out of the way and in some mysterious form let Jesus take my place somehow or come into me in a way that God would not need to see me but only see Jesus in me, right? This kind of phrasing. As though what God wanted to see was someone else, Wim, and not Rob, okay? Now I had to learn, what does it mean that the fruit, the real fruit of patience, should take form in my life as the restless, wiggly character that I am. Very quickly critical, very quickly worried, and very quickly dissatisfied. How can I, in other words, staying restless, wiggly, critical, worried, and unsatisfied? Because if you listen well, I worked on those words. They are not sins. They're not sins. I can stay just as restless, wiggly, critical, worried, and unsatisfied, but in a restored way. What would that be? Now, for me, it had much more to do with being set free from a kind of perfectionism, I learned. Not to think in all or nothing categories. All the time. Not to draw too quickly big conclusions or to think now or never, but to stay in my restless, wiggly, critical, worried dissatisfaction, to continue to look for things in a good way. Not to be happy when things are abstract and not concrete. Not to be happy when things get stuck and rusty or start to stack up in messy ways, but to look for creative and new ways to find order, to creative and new ways to find a path through things. Okay, that requires a certain restlessness and dissatisfaction. Now, I also always need to stay aware of the idols of all or nothing thinking, now or never thinking, which in a very special way will continue to plague me forever. But I'm allowed to look for a new and a living way as I am with my character and my characteristics. Once upon a time, I was about 10 years ago in Sicily. I was on a little weekend away by myself, and I was sleeping in a hotel where on the very first morning I was there, just outside my window, they started to work on the road at 7 in the morning with all kinds of drills and digging machines. And, you know, when trucks are backing up, they make that awful peeping beep, beep, beep noise, the whole, all kinds of noise. And at breakfast in the hotel, the owner, the old guy who owned the hotel, came to me and offered, his apologies, I'm so sorry for all the noise. And I said, very honestly, it was no problem. It didn't bother me at all. And that's very true, because for me, a weekend away has very little to do with sleep. For me, the main point of a weekend away is that I go somewhere where I have nothing required of me, by myself or by anyone else, so I cannot disappoint anybody. That, to me, is the idea of freedom. So some noise in the morning, no problem. So I told him, no problem. It didn't bother me. And this old guy, this old Greek, looked at me and he said, I suppose then you have a restless soul. And he just walked away. I thought, okay, is that nice? Is that good? Yeah, did you just see right through me? I mean, what is that? But because he didn't say it with any judgment at all. He just sort of shrugged his shoulder and nodded and walked away. And I think he meant, actually, I had to think about it, my old breakfast. I thought, you know, he meant that I was not immediately upset or disturbed by the restlessness outside. And he thought, well, luckily for this guy, apparently, because he's already restless inside. He's just sort of in tune with the restlessness around. Now, I don't know if it really works that way. Other moments, I don't have that peace, so I don't know if that really works. But I did think that was interesting, because it was one of the first times that I thought, hey, wait a minute, maybe my clear inner restlessness isn't automatically to be seen as something wrong, or that it's always just something bad or something, a handicap that I need to get rid of or need to be forgiven or healed of, or learn how to avoid. Maybe there's some kind of advantage in it somewhere. You know, maybe there's even in restlessness a sort of hidden, very vulnerable, but still good aspect of an image-bearing quality that I have, that I reflect God's image in this way, and that it's begging to be restored and not to be amputated. Okay, that it's begging to be restored and not cut out or cut away. Now, this is the point then. If I'm invited by a gospel to live a life with God and through God as a disciple or a follower of Jesus who wants to work in me, what is that going to look like? Okay? How can it be something that at the same time accepts and recognizes and affirms me as the person I am, and in the same moment still offers me healing, correction, and a push to become better or more free in some way as a person I am? How can that go together? Freer from the lies and the choices and the habits that might be making me less human or less Rob as I'm meant to be. I think this can be really interesting for people who already believe, who say they are Christians, who know they are Christians, or for people who are just curious or even critical of what they have heard is actually the biblical message about what a life of faith actually means. So I want to take some time now to look at what the Bible actually says about it and walk through some scriptures that I think have often been misunderstood. At least in my life, they were taught to me in a way that was not totally correct. In the language of the letter to the Ephesians, okay, we call this the putting off of the old self and the putting on of the new self. In Dutch, you can say mens. It's even the new man or the new human, the new person. Or in the language of Psalm 139, there's spoken about walking on or being taken off of a godless path, or a path of pain, literally, the pain-causing path, the damaging way, you could say, and being put on or being led on the eternal path. Okay? So what is this? What is this language? This is personality redeemed. This is what we're talking about. Now, as I said, I think it's been too bad that in some Christian circles that this tension has sometimes been approached much too simply with the answer, well, what would Jesus do? Or how can I look more like Jesus or become more like Jesus? If what people mean by that is this. This only took me about 30 seconds to find on internet, all of these. As though the message is somehow I need to be taken away. Who I am. And a whole new identity needs to come in its place as God's child. Lord, empty me of me. Not of sin, not of something else. Empty me of me so I can be filled with you. It's not about you. It's all about Jesus. Okay? Less of me, more of you. If this message is presented this way, as though I need to get a whole new identity and be gone, and that as though at the core of things, I'm the problem that God needs to get rid of first, then I think that's very much too bad, because that's not what the Bible teaches. There is, of course, in the Bible, very strong language in different places about the radical change we can experience and we even long for, okay? I'm not avoiding the idea of change here. God wants to bring it. This putting off of the old self, dying to the self, right? Losing your life to find it. Not my will, but yours be done. This kind of language is there. But if you miss the context of all of these verses, if you don't see them and read them in the framework of the larger meaning of God's revelation, a lot of really annoying questions suddenly pop up if this contrast is left alone. The question arises, and I've heard it many times here at La Brie, if I would become a Christian, or if I really grow in my faith the way God wants it, if it really is being emptied of me, less of me and more of Him, am I really the problem? Do I really need to be erased? If I would follow God, would I even know myself in 10 years? Am I supposed to not know myself? Do my personality and my characteristics, as I know them now, do they count as anything good? Does it matter who I am? Or is sanctification or Lebensheil, is the way of faith a kind of holy brainwashing and replacement of who I am? Okay, so does it, when we say I want to become more like Jesus, does that mean putting off the self in the sense of I just have to more and more give up who I am? Lose who I am, maybe miss who I was, undergo a lot of amputations and surgeries. And I will tell you right now, in the deepest way, the answer is no. Just like the redemption of the earth is not first and foremost burning up of everything so that we can all fly away to heaven somewhere. It's about the restoration. The problem is not the creation. The problem is not how I've been built. The problem is the curse which has affected all of creation and put it on a painful path in the way I act, in the way I think, in the way I feel. Okay, that's a very deep infection. But the first word is the creation itself, and that is allowed to long for restoration. And this is good news. Because I'll promise you, the older you get, the more you're going to find out. We do not change in personality. Okay? I remain Rob in the basic way. I will never become Wim. I will stay restless, wiggly, critical, worried, and dissatisfied. Now, this Rob can long for a radical change in how I live those things. But if I am thinking or praying or asking, even with the best intentions, that I should become another person to make God happy or to be able to believe in Him, then I have a big problem because it's not going to happen. And that wrestling, when I figure out it's not going to happen, can lead to some very crippling doubt about the truth. I think it's always moved me the most in all my time here at LaBreathe when I see someone stuck in that wrestling and that crippling idea that God needs me and wants me and wishes for me to become another person. That their personality is the thing that stands in the way of their freedom. And therefore they don't want it, or they feel that it must not count or must not work for them. Because that's supposed to be how it works. I told my daughter I would tell a little story on her, but this became concrete for me one night when one of my kids was praying in her deep stress and worry about a test the next day. God, will you help me not care anymore about this? I wanted to be free from this anxiety. And when I heard that, it broke my heart a little bit, because I thought, no, wait a minute, we cannot pray this, that you become another person. What's the real problem here? That you care? Is that the problem? Or is it the lie that if you don't do well, you're a zero? Is it the lie that if you fail it, you might as well never have even started? Is it the lie that if it goes wrong, you should be rejected? Or if it doesn't go perfectly, everything is lost? That's the problem. So it was on that moment, on that evening, many years ago, that I thought, oh, the first thing that has to be prayed is, thank you, God, that you made me to care. First, thanks for the creation. And then pray, now set me free from lies. And that may be a lot of hard work. But the first thankful prayer, it was critical to that. Okay, so I'm not saying there won't be any more fight or struggle at all. But I want everybody to be free, just as God does, from false fights, false struggles. So listen well to how Ephesians 4 actually says it about the old self and the new self. What it says there, if you have learned Christ in this way and been taught by him, just as the truth is in Jesus, then regarding your earlier way of living, okay, Lebenswandel, your earlier path, notice the language, how consistent it is. The old self, put it off, that old self, which is, forget the English language now, which is going down in bedrieglijke begeerte. It's also such a beautiful phrase, isn't it? That would also be a great band name, the bedrieglijke begeerte. These the misled desires, the deceptive desires. Okay, so put off this old way of living and be renewed in your mind. And put on the new person, the new self, which is being renewed in the image of God, in true justice and holiness. And then he adds, put aside and put off the lie and speak the truth. Okay, this is a whole mouthful, but what does this mean? What's actually being taught here? I think the first thing to notice, just grammatically speaking, is that this instruction cannot mean put off the old self in the sense of your personality and your identity and your being. He calls it a path. And if you just look at the grammar, I, in a particular way, have to remain in this formula because I am putting something off and I am putting something on. He doesn't say, let God do it. He says, you do it. So whoever you is stays. Okay, that's the instruction. Whoever you is, stays. Okay, otherwise, who is it that's putting something off and putting something on? So I remain in Paul's instructions here as the person who puts something off and puts something on. That's literally how he describes it. So I remain. That's the important thing to hear. Even in other letters where something very similar is said, if you listen well, And I'm going to show you down there on the bottom right. It's not about you. It's all about Jesus. Well, they say that's what Colossians 3 says. I'm going to show you what it really says about putting off the old and putting on the new. There it says, Do not deceive one another any longer, now that you have put off the old self and its leefwijze, its way of living, and you have put on the new person, the new self, which is continually being renewed, according to the image of the Creator, and that you have come to see it this way. Okay, they're the same languages, I think, very affirming that who's putting it off and who's putting it on? It's not that it's nothing about me at all. It's all about me doing this and having this help from God. Okay, I am being put on a new path. I am getting new clothes. That person stays in the literal language. Now, even in other texts, in the word new, this becomes really important. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, maybe some of you know this verse, we are told, so, whoever is in Christ is a new creation. The old is gone, and see, the new has come. Well, you think, whoa, that's pretty clear. That's a removal and a replacement, right? You could think, well, you have to listen well to the language. I learned, again, from Wim in his little book about the earth, the word used for new here in Greek is not neos, which means brand new, like the creation of the world. The word used here is kainos, which means never before seen. Okay, that's different from brand new. Never before seen means, okay, it's a radical thing. We've never seen it before, but there's plenty of space for it to have continuity with what was before. Okay, just like with the earth. That gold has never looked that pure, but it was there. It's free from the impurities now. The continuity is there. It's not the gold is burnt away and something shiny brought in its place. Even in the letter to the Galatians, chapter 2, verse 20, another one which sounds very extreme if you only read this part. In Christ, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. You think, well, okay, there we have it finally. It's really a replacement. Well, I was challenged one time with this verse while giving this workshop, and I hadn't looked at the verse yet, and I thought, ooh, it's best to undermine in the text. Yeah, and it out. So now, let's look at it, I said. And we opened it, and what did we see? You got to read the rest of the verse, man. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me, says Paul. And the life I now continue to live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who has loved me. So that first one is not, I'm removed in my identity in any sense. It simply means I am no longer the captain. I am no longer autonomous. Because I still live in the flesh in thanks, not in the hereafter. It's all there. This is about a restoration as an individual in the here and now, in a radically new way, but not replaced, but restored by God's love. Okay, so what is this? This is the theory. Now, what does this look like then? Going back to Ephesians 4, it's great. Because, fortunately, Paul goes right in with concrete examples. Okay, the focus is actually not the putting off of the old self at all, really. Okay, this as an identity or a personality. Because when Paul summarizes the whole passage, we already read it, what does he say actually needs to happen? What really needs to be put off is not the identity, but the lie. Put off the lie and speak the truth. Okay, get rid of the lie and speak the truth. The lie is the problem, not your identity and your personality. The sin is the problem, not who you are as a created person in and of itself. Okay, so the focus here is a freedom that comes from truth, renewing who we are and who we are allowed to become. Okay, so we are brought more to the path of life, eternal life, away from the damaging and damaged path of the curse. Now, Paul becomes real concrete real fast. He says right away, well, let's take the thief as an example. The one who has been a thief, the one who has stolen, let him steal no more. But, he says, let him work hard to make something valuable with his own hands, to be able to share with the one who has in need. This is a great formula. Now think about what he's actually saying here. Not just the thief should stop it and cut it out and be replaced. It says, let the thief stop stealing, but get busy making something and sharing. In other words, gifted hands and clever minds can be put to use in a heist to steal things. We got plenty of movies about that, don't we? And they're fun. We kind of root for the criminals because they're so smart and they're so clever. And we want them to win over the stupid cops, right? That can be true. But gifted hands and clever minds and strategic thoughts can also be put to use to make something valuable and share it. So the successful thief is somebody who's smart and capable and who understands the value of things. By the way, longing for valuable things is never a problem in the true biblical message. There are a lot of ways to get valuable things in the Bible. And it's, in fact, advised to do it. You can buy it. You can earn it. You can get it as a gift. Or you can make it. Those are all relationally affirmed ways to get something valuable. You're just told not to steal it because that breaks relationships. Okay, that's what breaks your relationships. So, here the thief is asked not to stop being someone who has gifted hands and clever ideas and original strategies. No, not at all. You're allowed to continue to be that person, just not to steal anymore. And now, not turn your back on the world of valuable things either. Stay busy with them, but start making them and start sharing them. Just like Zacchaeus was told when he was caught being a thief. Learn to be generous with valuable things. Okay, instead of stealing, make it and share it with the ones who are in need, which, by the way, then might even help someone else avoid becoming a thief because they are taken out of their poverty or out of their need. Okay, so this is the restoration of the thief. In all his gifts and his longings and who he is, it's a radical kainos change, but it's not replacing who he is and asking him to be a different person. Okay, Paul takes it right into the next example in the very next verse. Let no bad language come over your lips, he says, as you put on the new person, the new self. Now, what's bad language? Well, we know from other Bible languages, that the Bible text, that it's not just curse words or swearing, right? It's all words that are damaging. All words that are damaging. And again, think about this. Damaging language is effectively destructive because the people who are speaking it have talented tongues and they know exactly how to read a situation and how to have the highest influence on that moment to bring damage. That's what makes it work, right? Insults or gossip or lies or false witness. These are all things spoken against in the Bible as destructive language. Because there's some talent at work, right? So, notice again, in the new self that you put on, the new path you should walk, it doesn't just say stop talking. It actually says keep wagging that talented tongue. Continue to use your ability to read a situation and to have influence on it, but now with a different goal. Not to destroy, but to do something good. And that's the way the verse continues. That what you say can be a timely blessing for the building up of the one who hears it in grace. So that you actually build up the one who hears it. Okay, so again, you hear this. The tongue isn't to be cut out as a way of salvation. It's not about being replaced as a powerful user of words or an amputation of your ability here. Maybe it's even what you're good at. It's a deep restoration from curse to blessing. So it's not about getting rid of the image bearer in us, that I have to disappear to make room for Christ. But just like Zacchaeus himself, if I am set free to bring a blessing in the world as the person I am. That's God's goal with his kingdom, that I stop spreading the curse and that I'm used to spread the blessing. Now, in a lot of Bible stories, you see exactly this dynamic. So I want to bring a few that were somewhat new to me when I finally understood how to read the Bible this way. Think about these two sisters we know from Luke chapter 10, Mary and Martha. You see this, some of you will know this scene, okay? Mary's sitting, listening to Jesus teach, and Martha's all busy here, right? As we know, busy with everything, all the meal and the preparation and being a hostess. And Jesus uses the word meremna. Well, in the Greek version of what Jesus says, the word meremna is used as how Jesus describes Martha. What does meremna mean? It means literally being pulled in every direction. Someone who's meremna is someone who is pulled in every direction. And here it seems to be a disadvantage because she is compared with Mary, who is sitting full focused at the feet of Jesus listening. Now, Martha feels left behind by that and all the work that needs to be done. And she wants Jesus to get Mary in action and help her. And Jesus says to Martha, 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 you are letting yourself be pulled in every direction. One thing is important, and Mary is choosing that one thing. You should also do that. Now, what did Jesus mean when he said, you should be choosing the one thing like Mary? Does that mean that Martha should look like Mary? That she should go sit down at Jesus' feet and listen with full attention? I don't think so. We're not told in this story what happens. My full conviction is that Martha could continue to cook and clean and broom and whatever, but with a renewed spirit about what really was the problem. And the reason I think that is because of another story with these two sisters. And I was happy to find a painting where here, in both cases, Martha's the one talking to Jesus and Mary's the one with her head bowed in full focus. In John chapter 12, both sisters are now appearing again, and they're both deeply hurt and upset because Jesus did not come and save their brother Lazarus, who was sick, and now he's died. Okay, they're both deeply sad, and they're actually a bit angry at Jesus if you read it. Why, if you had come on time, he wouldn't have died. They both say that. They don't understand what happened. Now, what I want you to notice is in this story, this time it's Mary who has the problem. Mary seems stuck in her sadness and her despair. She doesn't ask any questions about it of Jesus. She seems very close to collapse, and maybe even believing that Jesus doesn't keep his promises. Jesus becomes upset when he sees that and takes action. But it's actually Martha in this story who does not draw the wrong conclusion, who does not jump to despair. She's disappointed. She's just as mad. But what does Martha do? She lets herself be pulled in any direction. She suddenly says, well, okay, I'm mad and upset, but what else can happen? What else might be available for you to live up to what you said, that this sickness would not end in death? Because everything's possible with you, right? Okay, she's open. She asks these questions. So suddenly, meremna is her gift here. Being pulled in every direction helps her. And Mary, with her deep focus, is in collapse. So the one thing that's important is not that Mary should become like Martha, or Martha should become like Mary in a certain kind of character or behavior, but that they both see, what lie do I need to put off, and to remain the person I am in freedom, so that I can be brought to see the truth, to live in the truth, as I am intended to be, the person I am. They can learn from each other. I think that's fine. We'll come back to that. But the point is that they both are given a form of blessing that is unique to them in the freeing of who they are. And they can both bring a kind of curse according to who they are into that situation. That's the theater of their white stone, their new and living way. Think about Saul, the Pharisee, who later became Paul. Here we see Saul standing up on the left as he watches Stephen being killed, being stoned to death. Okay, Stephen, who was one of the evangelists of the time. Paul was overseeing, Saul, the Pharisee, was overseeing his martyrdom at that moment. Now, Saul was known at that time as a person who, full of fire and stubbornness, was persecuting the Christians, chasing them much farther than he was required to, following them to other cities, searching them out in their hiding places, driven and disciplined. Now, who did God choose when God decided the time is ripe for the gospel to be taken outside of Jerusalem? Did he look for a quiet, sweet guy who was a really good listener and could help encourage people all the time? Okay. Those also have a place in the kingdom, of course. We need our Henry Nouwens. But that wasn't the calling of Paul. He needed to be knocked off his horse, yes, that's true, and to be still for a minute. But after that, his calling was still to be stubborn, strong, breaking boundaries, going farther to other cities, to other places that no one else dared to go, disciplined, but now as a blessing, to bring a blessing of shalom to people and not spreading the curse. Doing it, not driving his own life and his own way, but in the service and dependence on God. And here he stands again in the same way, but now teaching on Mars Hill in Athens, a place which no one else would have been able to do like he did at his time, understanding his environment. Think about Moses. Moses hesitated, if you know the story, when he was at the burning bush, when he was called to set my people free by God, to set the Israelites free out of slavery in Egypt. And why was Moses hesitating? Do you remember the story? What did he say? I'm not a good speaker. I'm not a leader.
What if he doesn't listen? What if they don't believe me?
Right, exactly. I can't convince them. What if it's not, you picked the wrong guy? Now, I remember a whole sermon one time where a pastor was trying to explain that the way we should read this is that Moses probably stuttered or had a speech impediment. The guy didn't read the rest of the Bible. In Acts chapter 7, at the scene where Stephen is being killed, Stephen gives a history of the Israelites. And he tells, in verse 22, you can look it up, of chapter 7, that Moses, when he was a young man, was known for being powerful in word and deed. That was his character. He was known for being powerful in words and in deeds. But Stephen goes on to say, after he failed to set free the Israelites, because he already knew it was his calling as a young man, he failed to do it by killing the Egyptian, and the people didn't recognize him as the Redeemer, and they didn't follow him. So, convinced by this failure, which he tried in his own timing, he fled into the desert and only chewed on that failure for 40 years, so long that he convinced himself, see, I'm not powerful in word and deed. But what do we know? God gave him Aaron as a little crutch, but as we all know, Aaron didn't really help him that much. In fact, he became more of a problem than a help. Moses turned out to be pretty powerful in word and deed. And I'll remind you, this was also remained the theater of his greatest struggle. Being powerful in word and deed. And smacking that rock and forgetting not to do things in his own timing, but in dependence on and giving God the credit for it. So it remains the theater of his renewal and his struggle. So this is the theory in the Bible and also in all the stories. What I want you to take home as the message of redemption, personality redeemed. It's not about being removed, replaced, amputated, cut, putting masks on, whatever else you want to call it. It's being freed from lies about myself, about God, about my neighbor, and learning to taste how I can be a blessing as the person I've been built to be, the one who bears God's image in a special way, in my own unique way. However crooked that is, God is offering me healing to have that straightened out, to have that tot zijn recht laten komen, to come to justice, as to do it justice. Now, what could that look like for me now? I'll use two examples of people who've been here in La Brie, who both allow me to tell these stories, I should tell you. One was a woman who was here, I guess, some years ago. She was a very sensitive, very shy, introverted woman. She happily let other people have the spotlight, didn't speak up that much. But this insecurity had become a problem for her, that she was letting people sort of walk over her in her life. She was afraid in her insecurity to stand up for herself. Suffering so much under this fear of rejection, that even developing skin problems and hair loss, always living in the shadow. Now, as an answer to this, she had discovered and been given advice to take a course in an assertiveness training. And nothing wrong with that. Assertiveness training can be a good thing. But she said, in her own words, that she wanted to go learn to be another person, to learn to be an assertive person, to get rid of this fearful, shy self, and to become someone new. And it worked. After a year of training and after another couple of years of working on this and growing, she became quite a strong, outspoken, ambitious person and reached a high position in the job that she wanted. But I tell you all this because later she came back to La Brie with another story and in another crisis. Because she said one time, Rob, I looked in the mirror and I was terrified and shocked. Suddenly, I had become the person that I'd always hated. I'd become the one that always ran over me. The one who needed to live by her own rules, who only should keep account of her own plan, to not be afraid of what it did to other people, but to learn to speak for myself and to stand up for who I am. And it's damaged others, and it's left me just as alone as I ever was. What happened? Now, this was terrifying to her. And she was smart enough to see and to understand, instead of getting rid of the lie in her life, that she is not loved, that God does not see her, that God made her wrong or gave her a stupid personality. She had instead chosen, in an aggressive way, to get rid of herself and to replace it with this new thing, she called it. And she was able to do it. But it was actually a kind of a mask. It wasn't who she really was. And in a way, she said, I've betrayed myself. Now, it was beautiful then to see how, in a long process, she was able to discover and to receive God's love in a different way and to find the way to be set free, to be hospitable again, to let others have the spotlight, to let others have the first and sometimes the last word, to give the other space and really see who they are and value who they are, but not anymore out of fear, not anymore out of a panic that she wasn't worthy, not as some kind of holy doormat, we learned to call it, but to be actually a quite pastorally gifted manager in her work with her colleagues. That was a new way to remain who she was, free from lies, not to become a different person. Now, I also think about a young guy who came here to La Brie, was a seminary theology student. He was very sharp, very critical, very judgmental. But he had become a Christian as a student at university. And he'd always had this character, that he'd been very judgmental and quick to confront people, very competitive. And he was told and believed when he became a Christian that now God wants him to be nice. He's supposed to become sweet and tolerant and loving and caring for everybody all the time, right? And he knew that this would show that God was at work at him. But he had, of course, a great struggle inside because he had tried for years. But he knew that it was all a mask. And that when he went home and looked in the mirror, nothing had changed. Now for him, this had led to a very sad and disastrous conclusion that God doesn't care. And maybe isn't even real. That was his deepest fear. Because look, it doesn't make any difference. I'm not nice. Until he discovered, actually, that God actually wanted to keep him a discerning, an outspoken, leading person. Every group, every company, every family, every hospital, every church needs these people who are discerning, who understand right from wrong, who see things critically, and who can tell other people that. But not out of fear and a drive just to protect yourself or just to keep yourself up by tearing others down in a kind of strange competition because you're alone in this world. But to do it in a way that speaks the truth because you have put off the lie. That if you don't, you disappear. Or if you don't, you lose control. Or if you don't, that you don't matter. Or if you don't, that somebody else is going to get something they don't deserve. All these other things that bothered him. He said, and I remember how he phrased this because I thought it was so great. He said, I needed to discover, and I always have to look, how does God love the people in the room? Including me, but everybody. And if I remember to ask myself, how does God love everybody in the room? It adapted his language on how to be critical, how to say what's going on, how to give a critique and a discerning remark about the situation. Not to forget, God loves everybody in here. Me too. And this is the playing field, to make that a priority. And how can God bring us all further? Now, for both of them, for all the people in the Bible here, this, of course, isn't perfect in one day. It stays a struggle. Lifelong, a special, unique kind of struggle. But what I liked and what I saw in that man and in that woman, in spite of all their struggle, they were curious. And that was it. This is where I'm going to close. They were curious and they had a kind of courage to ask God, show me who I am and who I can remain. Okay? How can who I am still get a chance? To live in a new and living way. To get off the I don't want to be myself anymore train. Which sometimes feels very attractive and very easy. You know, clean slate. Just hit reset or something like that. That's very attractive to us these days. But that's actually the way of pain. That's actually the damaging way. The way of masks and difficulty and despair. And God loves us too much to allow us to go that way. So we're allowed to look for the ways that we reflect God's image in our character, in our characteristics as individuals, in a way nobody else does. You're allowed to be curious about that. Is it your discerning ability? Is it your easygoing patience? Is it being passionate and driven about things with strong language, reactive to things? Or is it being more sensitive? More careful and more caring. Do you like new horizons? Or are you better at creating comfortable homes? Are you more introverted or extroverted? Where and when? That can change for one person. Are you more of a team player? Or are you somebody who rather work alone? Now, most of these things I've just mentioned are not moral positions in and of themselves, but all of them can be put to use on a painful path, a path of pain, or an eternal path. They can be used as a blessing or a curse. Now, alongside that, we can ask, see, I think I skipped. Yeah, I want to do this in the language of Psalm 139, but I'll say it this way. Alongside that, I think we can ask not just how do I reflect God's image. We'll come back to this. But what are the specific lies then that distract me and that pull me and that influence me? What are the specific lies that I fall for and maybe keep alive in my life to keep me on a path of pain instead of the eternal path? What's the truth that I can speak against these lies? Is there a biblical truth I can learn to tell myself against those lies? I think sometimes it helps, and we'll come to this in just a second, to ask, where might I have picked up these lies? Which experiences in my life have reaffirmed them? Like, think of Moses, that failure. Look for it, not out of fear, but out of curiosity. You know, is there a lie in my life that says God made a mistake when he made me as the person I am? When he put me together in the womb, as it says in Psalm 139. Did he make a mistake? Or the lie that this one experience or this one big mistake or this one trauma in my life has forever put the eternal path out of reach? That I'm doomed in what I do? Or the lie that God's word about how we can bless each other, they weren't really given out of love. They were just given as oppressive rules. And they're just going to make me deny myself. I need to solve everything myself. These kinds of lies. Okay, whatever they are, put them away. Put away the lie and speak the truth to yourself and to other people, right? And I think this is a good tip. If you find it hard to do for yourself, practice with somebody else. Look for and tell someone else how you think they reflect God's image in their character. How you might see how they could be tempted to misuse it. And how beautiful it would be if they would be restored in who they are actually. And not become a different person. This is something you can practice to love your neighbor as yourself in this way. That's when it gets interesting. So I want to put it in the language of Psalm 139 now. Search me, know me. David prays there. See if I'm walking on the damaged way, the damaging way. You could say the way of not as it was intended. Okay? The way in which I do my neighbor damage as myself. And don't do it any justice. And put me on the eternal path. Now maybe you know this psalm, and maybe you notice how it begins. It begins with the statement, God, you already know me. You've already searched me. You know me already really well. So why does David ask at the end, God, search me and know me? If he started with the fact that it already happens, he knows it already. Well, I think, actually, David here is praying that he himself might be able to see a little bit more of that. It's actually a question, show me. He's curious. Show me a little bit of how you have made me as your image bearer in the womb. Where can I be thankful about that? What can I be thankful for in how I've been made? And show me, dig deep and show me where I am making a misuse of that. Which lies and which fears I'm following. And help me be moved in my Lebensweise and Lebenswandel, in my path from the one of curse to the one of blessing, as the person that I am. Now, it's a brave prayer. Be careful when you pray this. Let me see who I am. Sounds wonderful, but you're going to also discover where you misuse it and what your forever struggle will be. But it's the promise that you can be moved and you don't need to be afraid of it, because it's about your restoration, that you are going to be done justice as an image bearer of God in a slow and an incomplete but correct way and a correct direction, because God's doing it for us. So I summarized those. How do I reflect God's image? I got it in English too, if you want, in a minute. Which gifts, you could say, or characteristics do I have as an image bearer? Which gifts does my neighbor have? Especially somebody who I have difficulty with, you might want to ask. How do I make misuse of, or how do I misuse or make no use of my personal gifts out of fear, self-protection? Which lies can I get rid of? That I'm not loved, that I'm not saved, that I've been made wrong, that I'm only able to save myself in my own power. And how could I ask God to, yeah, set me free and restore me as I am, to give me a gift of spirit of curiosity, I think, to be receiving his restoration in the person that I am? How could I see my personality put on a path of blessing? Now, I think there's some things you can use, and I hope maybe to jump into the discussion this way if we want to concretely. I know that a lot of this is very individual, so if we want to do it in individual talks later, that's also fine with any of us who work here or with each other. Lots of tools are available for people who don't care anything about the Bible, but they don't know it. They use a lot of things that God has given us and how we are built to discover some of these things. How can I discover what some of my characteristics are as a way I'm built? Lots of tools available. Personality tests or these kinds of things you can ask your friends to fill in for you about what they see in you. What characteristics do they think you have? There are all kinds of training tools for discovering your own learning style or your personality type over there. The very big, very known Myers-Briggs. I think this one up here, the Big Five, or these kinds of things. These are easy to find online. Another one I have found quite interesting and useful, not just in discovering more about myself, but something about what we were talking together about in this direction of misuse, is called the core quality quadrant, the Kernqualitäts quadrant. And it's a thing that invites you to look at some aspects of who you are, maybe not the number one thing, but something you have in a particular situation, and how sometimes that can be Teufel von Trude, and that becomes a Falkau or a pitfall. Not something very different, but something very related. Okay, in the biblical language, you might say, because I listen to a lie or a fear, this becomes something of a curse rather than a blessing. And that it can be given in another type of person a very irritating challenge. And how you should not want them to become like you, but them to become, a restored version and not a on-sport, what do you call it, off-track version of themselves either. Now, that's very neutral training language. But if you think of an example, okay, somebody who's very punctual and tidy, when they listen too much to lies about the fact that if it's not tidy, then it's hell, or if people are not punctual, then they are insulting me, or if I myself am not punctual and tidy, then I should never have existed, or I need to really at least strive my best always to look like that because people might think bad things about me. You become a control person, overly organized, overly being the operative word there, destructively controlling, I think. And so the call then is to say, first, I'm thankful that I'm punctual and tidy. Lord, help me be set free from lies that make me this kind of person, that put me on this path and pull me back to this path so that I can learn to work well with people who leave things as they are. Because they sometimes, let's be honest, out of their own fears and lies, becoming too anal and becoming like those weirdos, they want to be messy and show them, I'll come late just to show you that this is not what we have to do. We do those kinds of things too. But then to help each other to stay on the holier, we can encourage each other in this direction. You could also use the Enneagram, I think, is a fun tool here. Again, these are things to be curious about. They're not just the keys or the solutions or the Gospels, and never to be used in the place of the Bible, but as something that helps. There's these nine sort of basic ways that people can have as a sort of a tendency or a path that they live. They're described in lots of places. I happen to like this one very much because these are quite positive on the character traits of the nine types. The Enneagram. But for each one they have a special pitfall. And that's also quite insightful. When I listen to lies in my life, that I am not an image bearer of God, that I have not been made well, that I am only a failure, that I do need to save myself and I need to make everybody else think that I'm saved in a way that isn't really who I am, I might end up exhibiting these destructive traits and these destructive tendencies. And the point is not to become another number, to become another type, or just to have those things erased, but to be restored as the person you are and not as somebody else. So, if you want it in, let me see, did I do it in English? Oh yeah, I think this is a better version. I changed some of the language here. Didn't want it to just be about gifts. I like it. I think the word characteristic or kenmerk is better. Kenmerk and eigenschappen, not just gifts. Anyway, we'll put it like this. That was it. That's what I wanted to bring.